Hi, I'm Alan Alexandroff, and I'm the director of the Global Symmetry Project. Much of our research and our project activity can be found at our website, which is globalsymmetryproject.com. You can see there that we have currently three main targets of our research, and they are the China and the West Dialogue, with a particular focus on U.S.-China relations, our research work on the Sustainable Development Goals, and all issues related to global governance, particularly the informals, that is the G7, the G20, the BRICS, and other informals as well. It's with great pleasure today that I welcome back to the virtual studio Homi Karas. In September, during the high-level week at the UN General Assembly, heads of state and government gathered at the invitation of the Secretary General to examine, at the halfway point, progress being made in achieving the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs. I wanted to get Homi's views of the progress he saw in achieving the 17 goals of Agenda 2030. I also wanted to get Homi's views of the two reports under the title The Triple Agenda of the Independent Expert Group. This group, the IEG, was convened during the G20 India presidency. The two volumes produced focused on the enhancement of the multilateral development banks, the MDBs, and their continuing targeting and focus on development, global development, and also the green transition. Homi, in fact, was the lead author for both volumes of the Triple Agenda. Homi is a senior fellow at the Center for Sustainable Development, housed in the Global Economy and Development Program at the Brookings Institution. In that capacity, he studies policies and trends influencing developing countries, including aid to poor countries, the emergence of the middle class, and global governance in the G20. His most recent co-authored and/or edited books are The Rise of the Middle Class, How the Search for the Good Life Can Change the World, Breakthrough, The Promise of Frontier Technologies for Sustainable Development, edited with John MacArthur and Izumi Ono, and Leave No One Behind, From Summits to Solutions, Time for Specifics on the Sustainable Development Goals, also edited with John MacArthur and Izumi Ono. So, it's my great pleasure to bring back into the virtual studio our good friend, Homi Karas. Well, welcome, Homi, to the virtual studio. Pleasure to have
Wonderful
you.
Wonderful to be here, Alan.
Oh, it's great. Okay, so September, we had the opening sessions of the UN General Assembly. This was the high-level week, UNGA 78. And it was a particularly important set of sessions because there were a number of summits that were held. And one of those was the high-level panel forum, the HLPF summit, where heads of state and government came together at what is the halfway point in the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals. And I want to go there, but before I go to what occurred, I did want to dip back because in the intro I mentioned that you were the lead author in preparing the report, A New Global Partnership, Eradicate Poverty, and Transform Economies Through Sustainable Development, which emerged in 2013 and was one of the critical precursors to the actual adoption of Agenda 2030 in 2015. So maybe you can explain to our listening audience exactly what was going on, what were you into at that point?
Well, thanks, Alan. So as you said, that's it's 10 years ago, so this is a real trip down memory lane.
Indeed.
I think that at that time, 2013,
Yeah.
It was just a couple of years before the Millennium Development Goals were going to end. Their target date was 2015.
Mm-hmm.
There was a general sense, I think, that in the UN that the setting of goals with some specific targets had actually been quite useful in mobilizing resources and attention and moving the needle on selected issues. So they were thinking about, well, what comes next? And so the report that I was the lead author of, they had convened a number of high-level experts. This was co-chaired by David Cameron, then Prime Minister of the UK, President Yudo Yono from Indonesia, and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf from Liberia. So as you can imagine, an advanced economy, a middle-income economy, and a low-income economy, with a number of people to say, so what should the UN do next? And there were a number of options. So I would say the big decisions were about, should one just build on the success of the MDGs and finish the job?
Mm-hmm.
Many of the MDGs were cast in terms of halve poverty. And so there were these memes about, well, you know, who runs a race and stops halfway there? So there was a whole agenda of trying to finish. And I think one of the big messages coming out of our report was that finishing would actually be technically feasible. So we were very concerned to make sure that what has now become known as the Leave No One Behind agenda actually took a prominent place in whatever the new agenda that the UN tried to bring people together on would be. So that's, I think, something that was really important. But that agenda had actually left out middle-income countries almost completely.
Mm-hmm.
Poverty reduction, basic education, these weren't really the big issues that the middle-income countries were wrestling with and grappling with. And what they were really thinking about is, how do we transform our economies? How do we get productivity growth and jobs and move up the ladder? And so we also, in the report, added quite a lot of detail about what it would take in terms of goals and targets to be able to move, allow middle-income countries to move up the technology ladder. And that's why you see a lot of emphasis on cities, on innovation, on infrastructure, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have to remember this was coming shortly after the Rio conference. And so sustainable development was on everyone's mind. And that was a very new concept because it was an effort to actually integrate the development community and the environmental community in a way that hadn't been done before. And so there was a very active discussion. Is this a good thing or is it a bad thing? I mean, the case for it being a bad thing was that when you combine these things, you tend to lose focus. You might lose, the ability to actually get something specific done. It takes you more into the realm of generics. But we actually decided that it was impossible to talk about development without talking about sustainability, mm-hmm. and vice versa. And so I think that was a very big decision to put on the table. And then a fourth aspect was one of, what do we do with all of these countries which are mired in conflict? And these weren't just low-income countries, they were also middle-income countries. But the idea of that we had to do something more to bring the peace community mm-hmm. into this agenda. Much of it through a focus on institutions and good governance, that became very important. And to be honest, when you look around the world today, you see exactly how important that agenda really is. So we took that on and integrated it, and then said, and all of this is only feasible if we have a new global partnership, and hence the title of the report. And the idea of that partnership was to say, in addition to all of these goals and the specific programs, we also need something, you know, quite different in terms of the way in which trade is conducted. And remember, the Doha round was still active at that point in time, mm-hmm. The way in which finance is organized, the way in which technology is diffused, and many of these other things that were about the global sharing of opportunity. So that was kind of the five big elements of change. And I think all of those ultimately were in fact reflected in the SDGs. I mean, that report became a kind of a, let me call it a base document mm-hmm. from which the, you know, official negotiations, you know, took off. But I would say that many of the principles that were laid out in that document were actually adopted into Agenda 2030 and are there, you know, in the SDGs, although the SDGs, of course, are more numerous, many more targets, and reflect ultimately a process, a very intensive process of negotiation by all member states to arrive at common ground. I still sometimes feel what an extraordinary time when the world, 193 countries and two territories, was actually able to come to a consensus document to say, this is our vision of the world we want to, you know, we want to live in. And so I think that power of a consensus document is also a very important component of the SDGs.
So now, you know, we come to the present. We're halfway through on trying to achieve the SDGs. They met and discussed. It was evident from the progress report that the UN put out that, quite honestly, the global community is way off, right, with respect to the 17 goals and the 169 targets, etc. You know, the Secretary General, obviously, at the head of this summit that occurred, urged members to accelerate action toward the goals of in the remaining half or seven and a bit more years. So, you know, how do you assess where the global community is with respect to the SDGs and what needs to be done, Homi?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that, Alan. I can share the assessment. That part is easy. Things aren't going well. The bigger question is, of course, what needs to be done? And, you know, there are certain things that every country can do on their own.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that it's important when we say, look, the SDGs aren't on track. It's important to recognize that that doesn't necessarily mean that there haven't been some improvements in the world. So we are actually making improvements, for example, with U5 mortality rates. Mm-hmm. They do continue to fall. not as fast as we had hoped and put out there as a target for the SDGs, but nevertheless an improvement. There is distinct improvement in antiretrovirals and people's ability to access some of these things. So there are clear areas where, even though we're not meeting the goals, mm-hmm. that there's still improvement in well-being. And I don't want to lose sight of that. Equally, however, there are areas where we've actually backtracked. So in many of the nutrition areas, child obesity, malnutrition, hunger, there are actually more people who are, hungry in today's world than there were in 2015. And that's just not acceptable. And I think it results from the fact that we are, in this world that people call a polycrisis, and our attention keeps getting diverted, and we leap from one crisis to the next crisis. There are some people who say, well, what do you expect? Things aren't going so well because we had, this extraordinary episode of COVID-19 when right. in many parts of the world, the economies just shut down. And there's undoubtedly COVID had a had an impact. But I would have to say that the trends that suggested that we were off track on most of the SDGs in many cases preceded COVID-19. So, right. for example, the trend on what was happening to extreme poverty, it started before COVID-19 hit us, and it's a reflection of the fact that actually in many high poverty countries, the process of economic growth was stalling. Mm-hmm. And we weren't able to do much about it. So I think when you say, well, now what can be done? It's also about what can be done at what level. So one of the things about the SDGs is it requires action by national governments, by subnational governments, by cities, by the business community, by academia, by citizens like you and me. And it takes a while for that kind of accountability, personal accountability, to really filter down. But perhaps now we're seeing a little bit more of that, and hopefully things will start to accelerate in the second half. I mean, that's the... That's what I think everybody is looking for.
You're quite right in suggesting it's quite holistic, and it operates at national level, subnational level, down to local communities. And there clearly is a lot of energy that you can see communities all across the globe who are, seeking to up their game with respect to achieving the goals. What's always struck me, and lots of analysts find it hard to get at it, but it the real seeming me hesitation is at the national level. I mean, if you look at it, the clear example, unfortunate clear example, is the United States. Never talks about the SDGs, right? Well, a couple documents will include it, but you don't have key cabinet ministers talking about it ever. I've never heard.
We had a breakthrough, Alan. The president mentioned the SDGs in his other address.
He did. It's true. But it simply doesn't fit, it seems to me, with the U.S. way of policymaking and priority setting. And so it just isn't there. It's a hole. Whereas, cities and so forth in the United States clearly are very committed, but it is a real problem. So I wonder, maybe you can, I'm sure you've reflected on this. There are some folks who say, look, you know, this is a global development effort hitting 17 goals. We need to, you know, in the next 7 years, we need to focus on some of the goals and try to achieve, 100% on those, even if we can't achieve all 17. What's your reflection on this? Do you subscribe to that view? Because there's a lot of pushback, obviously, people saying, no, you can't stop talking about all 17.
So I think that how to achieve focus can be done either by selecting some goals or by selecting some places. And one of the interesting things to me is that if you just look at the top five countries in the world that account for the shortfall in the SDGs, you'd probably get 50% pretty much across the board in most of the indicators that we track. So by that, what I'm saying is that, you know, if you take the countries, let's say one example, extreme poverty, take the five countries with the largest number of extremely poor people, that will be more than 50% of the total remaining poor people in the world. So we could focus on those countries and say, what do we need to do to dramatically change the trajectory in those countries? There's a target for road traffic deaths. So where are the road traffic deaths highest? It's in India and it's in the US. Well, there are specific things that could be done.
I see.
To, you know, change that. So what I'm saying is it's not necessarily focusing on the SDG on a few SDGs, but more thinking about for each SDG, where are the places where right now one can have
the most serious
most serious impact and reach the greatest number of people. So I do think that there's some scope for that kind of focus. But I'm a little reluctant to say, you know, one could drop any of the SDGs as a priority, because the reason why they're in the SDGs is because they are someone's priority. And you can't just tell someone, well, I don't care about you, so, you know, your priority doesn't count.
And they are often, they are very interconnected, the various goals.
They are interconnected, but again, our analysis actually suggests that maybe sometimes two or three are connected. So we have very strong evidence now, for example, that stunting is linked to sanitation in India. It's a good example where those two are clearly connected to each other. And so you have to move in tandem. And there are many other examples where two or three of the SDGs are linked. Yeah. It's not necessarily all 17 all of the time.
Fair enough. So let me turn to your most recent endeavor, which is, of course, the Triple Alliance. This was set up by...
The Triple Agenda.
Triple Alliance. I'm going into history. The Triple Agenda.
Yes.
This was most recent.
We don't like these war analogies.
I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, it's too much study too many years ago. So this was established by the G20 India presidency, and they set up this independent expert group, the IEG, and it, where the co-conveners identified were Larry Summers, the very well-known economist and former president, now emeritus of Harvard, and Nand Kishore Singh, the president of the Institute of Economic Growth and the chairperson of the 15th Finance Commission of India. Now, along with all the conveners, a technical team was gathered, and it included you. And you were also identified as the lead in preparing the report. There are, in fact, two reports for the Triple Agenda. Volume one is subtitled Strengthening Multilateral Development Banks, and volume two is subtitled A Roadmap for Bolder and Bigger Multilateral Development Banks. So what's the big story? Why these two volumes, and what are they saying?
Well, two volumes, partly because of the time constraints that we had in order to deliver something that the finance ministers of the G20 could reflect on. The first of those discussions was in July of this year. Mm-hmm. That was a very tight time frame. And so initially what we did was to put out for their discussions what I would call the big picture of what we saw. And what we saw was a huge need to accelerate the pace of long-term affordable finance for investments in the SDGs and in climate. We saw this as an integrated agenda, and so we put those two together in a way. Remember that there's still in global processes a tendency to treat climate finance separately from development finance. We thought this is not a good idea. And so integrating them was important. And we ultimately said, let's use the multilateral development banks in order to really push this agenda forward. Remember, there's a lot of call for actually setting up a new development institution, a so-called green bank or something like that. And, you know, one argument that we found persuasive was that it takes years to set up a new institution, and even more years until it can be scaled up into something that really effectively delivers financing. And if you just take the climate agenda, that would mean, 7 years, we'd be talking about 2030 before anything new could really get started. And that would just close many of the opportunities that we currently have, and everything would become much more expensive. We don't have 7 years to wait on the climate agenda in emerging markets right now. So there's a lot on what the, MDBs can do. There's a lot on it's the triple agenda, because what we advocate is that in addition to their standard development mission, they add a climate mission. And indeed, in Marrakesh, the World Bank has now added basically something like, poverty reduction on a livable planet. So taking squarely this idea that climate and other global challenges, global public goods, need to be addressed at the same time.
Fine. Yes.
We talk about the agenda as being something that would need to triple the sustainable lending volume. One of the things we saw is that for some time, partly because of the success with global poverty eradication, the MDBs have actually shrunk in relative size to a level where right now they are not making what I would call a material impact on the big challenges that the world is asking them to respond to. So we talk about tripling the sustainable lending levels. Mm-hmm. And then we also talk about trying to change the financing stack from one which is, right now there are two prongs. You either have everybody organized collectively in a capital increase, and there are very few episodic capital increases for these institutions. They're long drawn out processes. So that's one track. And then a second track is anybody who wants can basically just give the institution some money to do something, essentially to create a small trust fund.
Okay.
And that has proliferated into literally hundreds of these things. But the trust funds are all unleveraged, whereas the general capital is leveraged. Mm-hmm. And we thought, actually, there should be something in between where you could have a few people moving together that would also have some leverage. And we suggested that that should be a global challenges funding mechanism. So that's the third part of the triple agenda in the first volume.
Yes, and a new funding mechanism that you've identified. Now, why did you not focus on the World Bank and the IMF, which are the traditional IFIs, as opposed to the MDBs?
Well, the World Bank, of course, is the most important of the MDBs historically.
Historically.
And I think that our terms of reference was really about the long-term finance for development and climate. And what the IMF does is not that. Their role is the short-term role of stabilization and avoidance mm-hmm. of disorder, particularly of currency disorder. In countries. So avoidance of debt crises, avoidance of big financial crises, etc. So it's quite a different role.
Okay.
And the IMF usually tries to provide finance for quite short periods and then get it repaid. I'm not talking about, they have a separate program for low-income countries. We can come to that. But the bulk of their efforts are actually, provide liquidity at a certain point in time. And then as countries regain the confidence of markets, then they repay the IMF and move to more standard borrowing practices. But the IMF has never been designed as an institution to provide what I would call long-term sustained development finance. And that was the thrust of our terms of reference.
So, in effect, the triple agenda it focuses on boosting shared prosperity, making general prosperity the aim, and then talking about the means that you identify in the triple agenda. And then you talked about tripling the amount of sustainable lending. So the figure you used was $390 billion, right? And thirdly, and I would add in that you do talk a fair bit in your recommendations about drawing in private sector investors, and that means a change in the way in which investing is to occur with the MDBs, and then a new funding mechanism. So, I mean, very comprehensive, but I guess the question becomes, is there any advances being made within this frame of the triple, right, of the triple agenda? Are we seeing take up with respect to the very comprehensive report on the MDBs?
So it's very early to tell. The second volume, which basically spelled out the mechanics of the what exactly needs to be done. So the first volume basically said this is what needs to be done,
right?
And then the second volume spelled
the way to
out
do it.
This is the way to do it. So the one thing I can say is that at Marrakesh, the G20 finance ministers discussed the reports, both of them as a collective.
Okay.
And in their communique, they said they appreciated the work and they welcomed the documents. And the Brazilian G20 presidency has said that they would take up many of the elements of this agenda. The MDBs also met, the heads of the MDBs, and they also endorsed the recommendations of the report. So in some sense, I would say the general thrust,
mm-hmm.
I think, has been taken on board. And then, as in all of these instances, the devil is in the details. And it's one thing to be supportive of something, but when somebody asks you to actually then pay for it, you might have a slightly different tune. So that's the stage where we are currently. I think that there's a great deal of pressure on the MDBs now to deliver more, and they can actually deliver more with the resources that they already have. But we observed in these documents that ultimately to achieve the kind of scale and impact that we would like, they will inevitably have to come back to shareholders for additional support. And shareholders should be, you know, prepared,
mm-hmm.
I think, to do that, because it would send a signal to say, we know we're asking you to go through large, complex undertakings.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take many years. We're going to be with you through that process. And I think that kind of assurance gives people the confidence to get started now. Otherwise, people say, well, I'll sort of get started, but I don't quite know whether I'm going to get the support that I need. So maybe I won't go too far and I'll wait to see what happens. All of these kinds of games, to be honest, I don't think we have the time to be able to afford to indulge in. We have to have clear signals that say, no, we're going to do this. We're going to do it now. It's going to be a big, bold, new investment program that is going to actually have transformational change. We are after transformational change in the countries that take on this financing and in the MDBs that deliver it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's evident that it's a big picture approach. I mean, you know, and clearly, you know, you talk a fair bit about drawing in the private sector where there is the kind of funding you need. I guess the question is, but still, at the end of the day, you have, you know, the national governments. And, you know, I look at, you know, again, I hate to say it, but I look at the United States, I would think, the notion of enhancing lending, I mean, they're talking about $25 billion increase in the short term, right? I would think the prospect of that is pretty low at this juncture, given American politics.
You know, our job is not to think about the politics. Our job is to lay out
the policy.
what needs to be done. Some people mm-hmm. have said this is such an ambitious agenda.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an ambitious agenda. It's a deductive agenda. It starts by saying this is what you want to achieve. This is what it will take to get there.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to achieve that, okay. But you know, so
that's what's needed.
But this is what's needed. If we mm-hmm. want to stay remotely within 1.5 degrees or in this range of 1.5 to 2 degrees, this is what it will take. If we don't want to stay there, then we don't have to do any of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's as crude as I can sort of lay it out. but I think it just needs to be said that you will not get transformational change without investments,
mm-hmm.
and investments cost money. Many of these countries don't have the money. If the international community is not willing to support them, they will have to, everybody in the world will have to live with the consequences.
Okay.
And as we're observing now on a daily basis, the consequences are quite severe. I mean, potentially much more dramatic and more severe than even we have anticipated in the report.
Fair enough. Well, we clearly need to come back to you in let's say, a year or so to see, you know, because it is such a big picture, big agenda item. But, you know, and so we will call you back to provide that kind of assessment, Homi. But are you optimistic at this point, or that's not your remit? So you're neither optimistic nor not optimistic about it, or pessimistic?
I think that there is forward movement on the MDVs, which I've not seen in some time.
Okay.
That's a good thing. With all of these, I think the big question is going to be speed and urgency. And the group of think tanks that were involved in the secretariat that was supporting these reports, we've all agreed that we will take a look in advance of the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank next year.
Okay.
To say this is what's happened, and we'll do another stock taking before the fall meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. So next October to say this is what's happened. So we're all quite keen and eager ourselves to see what are people going to do with any of this, and I will report back to you at that time as to what we've found out.
That's great. I mean, we have two inflection points that I can put in my notebook to get back in touch with you to see whether progress has been made. One last little point. Did the finance ministers set up an assessment mechanism? Because that was another thing that you called for.
No.
They didn't.
No, they didn't.
Was that disappointing?
You know, I think that they have many of these kinds of groups. They don't want to keep adding to the bureaucracy. The G20, as you know very well, Alan, doesn't have a permanent
secretariat
body, etc. So, you know, I think that the key will be for somebody to keep taking the agenda forward. And so for us, the big positive news was from the Brazilian presidency to say, yes, many of the things that are discussed here are things that we want to put on the agenda. And they in turn will add to it. I'm sure, for example, that they will have much more on the nature side of things.
Yeah, the biodiversity, particularly because of the Amazon.
And the biodiversity, yes,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
of you know, who they are. I mean, that's fair enough and quite quite right. So they'll have their own agenda, but this will always kind of be there. And ultimately, in all of these things, you have to situate any individual agenda in this larger context of exactly what is happening in the world economy.
Okay.
I look at things like whether we can increase investment rates in some parts of the world, get slightly higher growth rates in countries that are lagging behind.
Mm-hmm.
Because we will not be able to transform economies in Latin America and Africa if they're investing 20-21% of GDP.
Well, we will be back to you, Homi, because you've kind of set the landscape, and we now need to see what the shape of it is. So we look forward to coming back and seeing whether real progress, in fact, it's so vital. Real progress is being made. So thank you for joining us, Homi, today.
Thank you, Alan.